From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll explore why so many school districts have referenda on the ballot this November.
Later, several key Wisconsin environmentalists react to the major climate report that came out this week.
This report lays out such a stark warning that it would be deeply unfortunate, to say nothing of consequential for humanity's future, if we were to not take this latest assessment seriously and talk about it.
Rebecca Mackay's book on the AIDS crisis in 1980 Chicago has been shortlisted for the National Book Award.
And our cheese contributor brings us something brand new from right here in Wisconsin.
What's really exciting about Monroe, outside of the fact it's a new cheese, it's the only cheese of its kind being made in Wisconsin. It's a creamy, washed rind cheese.
We'll find out what that means coming up on Lake Effect after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. When Wisconsin voters go to the polls in less than a month, they'll be voting in some key national and statewide races, like the election for governor and lieutenant governor, U.S. Senate, and state attorney general.
But in many places, they'll be deciding the fate of requests from local school districts seeking money for major projects. In fact, the number of such referenda seems to be on the uphill swing, which is why we invited Jason Stein to join us. He's research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum in Madison and author of a new study on school referenda. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Do you think school districts are seeing something in the general attitude of voters in 2018 that makes them optimistic that these ballot measures at least have a good chance of passing?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think any calculation by school district officials would involve first need and second how practical it is to go to the voters in that sense. So I would suspect that this case is no different, that both of those concerns are coming into play. You don't go to the voters if you don't feel like there's some need for it, and you don't go to the voters if you feel like it's hopeless in terms of getting it passed.
What have the trends been in terms of the numbers of ballot questions around Wisconsin school districts and their approval rates been in recent years?
Sure. You're seeing that in terms of the number of referenda and their particularly their success rate in terms of how often they're approved, that has been rising since the Great Recession, since around 2011 or so. And then you're also seeing over that same time period, we are seeing an increase in the dollar amounts of the successful referenda.
And there's been some polling data out there, I gather, that shows people in Wisconsin are increasingly okay with increasing school spending in comparison to the need to hold property taxes down.
Right. So, I mean, that's what it takes us to why is this happening? And we identified, several factors. One is clearly the economy. When the economy is not doing well, both the recession of 2001 and the recession that went from 07 to 09, and in the aftermath, you see that school districts don't seek as many referenda, and the ones they do seek are not as successful. So that's one factor, and that may be that, voters, they may want to help their school district, but they may feel that they don't have the financial capacity, right? And we have been in an expanding economy for some time now, so that's clearly a factor. Another factor is clearly the local school district conditions, whether that's you have increasing enrollments, you need to build a new school, or your old school is no longer serviceable, or your enrollments are down because you're a rural Northwoods district, and you need to hold a referenda because of the financial stress associated with having fewer students, less state aid, less money available under state-imposed per pupil revenue caps. Okay, there's a couple. And then last, there does appear to be a shift in voter sentiment, at least in the Marquette Law School poll, which has been polling from 2013 to 2018 on this question of what is more important to voters, reducing property taxes or increasing spending. In two 2013 polls, you saw the respondents saying, a plurality of them saying that reducing property taxes was more important to them than increasing spending on public schools. And then in a 2015 survey and four surveys this year, you saw a majority of voters saying they favored increasing spending on public schools more than reducing property taxes. So you do, there does appear to be a shift there in voter sentiment.
Do you think, does the sheer number of referenda to fund school projects speak to the unique challenges that districts have with the way education is funded in Wisconsin?
In terms of numbers of referenda, this year is on track to be the highest number since 2001, but we have had years where just in raw numbers there have been more referenda. As far as the dollar amount, if we see the November 6th, there's more than $1.4 billion on the November 6th ballot in referenda. So far this year, about $650 million has been approved. If those November 6th ballot questions get approved at the rate that they have been so far this year, then we would see, you know, the highest amount in the state that we've seen, you know, going back to revenue limits being imposed in the 93-94 school year. So, you know, there's a little bit of difference between the raw numbers of referenda and their amounts. But again, overall, you know, we are certainly seeing an increase over what we were at 10 years ago.
There are some specific ways that districts can set up these referenda, a couple of ways they can ask for money, and there are also new laws in place, or at least a new law in place, governing the district's ability to use referenda. Can you kind of talk about the climate for being just the laws surrounding referenda?
Sure. Well, let me tell you about the types there are. The first type that was most common traditionally is debt referenda. So that's, you know, referenda where the school district seeks permission to borrow money for a capital expense like a new building or a big renovation. There's something called non-recurring referenda and recurring referenda, and both of those are for an increase in the school district's operating budget, higher property taxes and a higher, you know, ongoing spending. The non-recurring referenda is just for a limited period of time, several years. The recurring referenda is permanently. And we have seen those non-recurring and recurring referenda, especially the non-recurring limited ones, those have increased over time as a share of the total ballot questions that school districts are putting up. And then we have seen the legislature debated last session a number of kind of time, place, and manner restrictions on school district referenda, when they can hold these, and, you know, how, for instance, if they have one that fails, how quickly can they come back and have another one? Can they have these on a low turnout election like you might have a primary or something like that, or do they need to hold them on, you know, like fall general election where you have more voters turning out and more people making the decision of whether or not to raise taxes? And some of those restrictions passed, some didn't, which I think gives you reason to think that the legislature may consider that issue again when they return in January.
Can you give us a sense for some of the more ambitious requests out there on ballots this fall?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the big ones are, of course, debt referenda, because that wraps up a number of different years into one ballot question. And a lot of those are in the suburban Milwaukee and suburban Madison area. So the biggest ones are a $125 million referendum in Wauwatosa. And there's also a $139 million one in Middleton Cross Plains, west of Madison. And then in the suburban Milwaukee, you see districts like Waukesha, Oak Creek, both have about $60 million referenda. Pewaukee and Greendale both have ones that are more than $30 million. So, you know, a number of significant ones in the area in the upcoming weeks.
You mentioned the idea of voter turnouts and how that might affect things. Do you have any sense for how these ballot issues do in, you know, either a midterm versus presidential election year or a fall election versus a spring election, or, you know, what the common wisdom is about, you know, when during the year or when during an election cycle voters are more or less likely to pass a referendum?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, my long answer would be that we know that these ballot questions do better in the up part of an economic cycle. So, you know, when the economy has been expanding a couple years, they definitely do better. And when the economy is contracting, they definitely do worse. As far as the election cycle, to sort of give you a short answer to your question, I don't know.
Fair enough.
Jason Stein is the Madison-based research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can find a link to the forum's recent report on school district referenda at WUWM.com.
Keep listening to Wisconsin environmental activists react to a major climate prediction that came out this week. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Concerns about climate change were only heightened this week with a new report out. The UN asked 91 scientists from around the globe, called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to assess possible impacts from a warming planet. The team projects impacts to life and the world economy if countries fail to drive down CO2 emissions.
Environmental reporter Susan Benz covered the story earlier this week for WUWM News. She spoke about the report with Wisconsin natives Tia Nelson and Melissa Scanlon. Scanlon is a professor of law at Vermont Law School and calls the report a critical call to action that requires broad individual and political buy-in.
I think there's a lot of noise out there, so it's hard to reach people. And I also think that there's been a lot of distraction with people who deny climate change exists. Hopefully, people will see through that and understand that climate change is real. We're already experiencing increased problems with intensity of storms, droughts, water scarcity in some regions, too much water in others. And that's with 1 degree Celsius warming. So what this report is saying, we will see even greater problems the longer we wait to tackle the warming trends that we're seeing. We need to move our fossil fuel-based economy to one that's based on renewables. And these are human choices. It is possible to do this. As I mentioned to you earlier, the Iron Age didn't end because we ran out of iron. We made choices to reorder our economic systems and to innovate, and we're at that point, and we need to do that. The Nobel Prizes that were given out are directly aligned with this because they were given out to William Nordhaus and Paul Romer, honored for their work showing climate modeling and growth modeling that is actually quite hopeful that we can make these changes, but we need to commit to doing it.
So, Melissa, when you say human choice, are you talking about what our carbon footprint is?
What I mean by human choice is everything from the individual level, choosing to use public transportation or walk or bike instead of driving your car, to the larger level of demanding and voting for politicians who are leaders on these issues and who will be leaders who protect our future, and for those who don't, to vote them out of office, and to support those who truly are leaders in this area, because the decisions we're making about our economic system are going to be taking away choices for future generations who will have much more limited options if we don't switch off of fossil fuels onto renewables.
When it talks about the reduction of burning coal for electricity, even if everyone were on the same page, it's a major shift. It would be a big goal to reach in a relatively short amount of time. You feel it's doable?
I have great faith in our abilities as humans to set goals and reach them. If we choose to move off of fossil fuels and we make that our goal, we will figure out a way to get there. We have the technology to do it. We just need the political commitment to do so.
Wisconsin native Melissa Scanlon is a professor of law at Vermont Law School and director of the New Economy Law Center. Susan also spoke with Tia Nelson, who echoes Melissa Scanlon's contention that immediate climate action is required.
Nelson is the daughter of Gaylord Nelson, who's credited as the father of Earth Day. She spent a lifetime immersed in environmental work and is currently managing director of climate at the Outrider Foundation based in Madison, Wisconsin. Nelson says our individual choices factor into solutions, including the food we purchase.
I, until very recently, didn't know, and I've spent years working on this issue, I, until very recently, didn't know just how significant a greenhouse gas emission source came from food waste. If food waste were a country, it would be the third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the world after China and the United States. Americans throw away, the average family of four throws away $2,000 worth of food a year. There are simple steps that we can take in our daily life to reduce our role in food waste, and in doing so, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, ensure that food isn't being wasted, and which helps make it possible to provide food to those who need it. It's a pretty straightforward thing. Single-use plastic, significant source of greenhouse gas emissions, is the creation of plastics that are intended to only be used once. We can make a choice as we go about our day to avoid those purchases whenever possible. But ultimately, we need rational, sound public policy informed by sound science. We need to vote for politicians who are advancing a clean energy future for all Americans. This next election is a critical one in so many ways. There's been some recent analysis done, which honestly surprised the heck out of me. It turns out that people who consider themselves environmentalists are voting at a much lower percentage. So if 45% of eligible voters voted in the last midterm, it was barely 20% of eligible environmentalists voted. That really was quite a surprise to me. If people who think a clean environment, the right to drink clean water and breathe clean air and have a clean energy future, if those are issues you prioritize and you're not voting, you're not having an impact on the decision that our policymakers are making, whether it's at the state level or the national level. Participatory democracy is only as effective as those who participate in it. And I was really surprised. I don't know why the number is lower, but I know that we're not going to get where we need to go if we don't show up and vote.
So last Earth Day, Outrider, with whom you now work, launched its climate change initiative, a website. Do you feel that more people are beginning to understand the situation we face and that action is imperative?
I do. Outrider has been focused much of this year in the climate program on creating a series of climate solutions videos. These are social first short form videos that we're distributing on various digital channels that tell the story of climate solutions largely from the perspective of individual action. I mentioned to you earlier that if food waste were a country, it would be the third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. That video has been viewed over 6 million times. And I've received emails from Costa Rica to Washington, D.C., to right here in Wisconsin from individuals who have seen that video and wanted to know more. We'll be working with the climate communications experts at Yale to deploy a variety of strategies to disseminate and amplify these messages of climate solutions. But ultimately, we have to do more than that, and we have to create the political will to put in place the clean energy policies that are going to help us avoid these projections that the report has laid out for us in such stark terms.
How do we factor in the current policy and seems to be an evolving policy at the federal level when it comes to environmental protection?
Well, I think it goes back to something we were discussing earlier, namely that we elect members of Congress, members of the United States Senate, the governors of our state, to advance clean energy policies, and then hold, in the case of federal regulatory entities, hold those entities' feet to the fire to robustly implement those policies. You know, carbon pollution has, greenhouse gas emissions has been labeled in a much-watched Supreme Court case as a pollution under the Clean Air Act. EPA is required under the Clean Air Act to protect the citizens of this great country. We've got to put in place political leadership to pursue a clean energy future and have the federal government follow through and implement those policies. And that's going to require all of us to become more involved and engaged. Did I talk to you about Project Drawdown? If you want a little more hope and optimism and a little more climate solutions, just Google Project Drawdown.
Okay.
And a guy named Paul Hawkins reached out to scientists around the world and asked them to help him, in essence, crowdsource the 100 climate solutions. And he paints a picture in which we rapidly begin reducing emissions, and then we get to net zero through implementing all of these strategies. But what this is where I learned about the food waste thing. But if you look at the top 10, and you can Google top 10 Project Drawdown, and you'll get the top 10 solutions. A couple of them are going to surprise the heck out of you. Well, at least they surprise the heck out of me. And it includes educating girls in the handful of countries that are experiencing high population growth. It turns out getting a girl through eighth grade is the strongest predictor of how many children she has. And the number one solution is banning hydrofluorocarbons in air conditioners because it's a very potent greenhouse gas. There's a whole bunch in there on land use, changes in ag practices, protecting and restoring grasslands, wetlands, forests, improving timber management practices, all doable things that have a whole associated co-benefits for the environment, for human health, for the economy. And he put forward a scenario in which we stabilize, reduce, and then through the deployment of all of these practices, we're actually sucking carbon out of the atmosphere because we're improving how we produce food, we're reducing how much food we waste, we're improving the way we manage our lands, and that's sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere. Nobody's ever done a project like that before. It is a source of great inspiration to me. It sits here on my desk. I have ordered and given away so many copies of it. For every young person that comes in here and asks me, wants to talk to me, which happens fairly often, I give them the book. So for me, that's what gets me up in the morning, the chance to tell the story that we can solve this. We know what we need to do and help people understand both the challenge and the opportunity.
Tia Nelson is Managing Director of Climate at the Madison-based Outrider Foundation. You can find a link to the IPCC report on the effects of climate change at WUWM.com.
Illinois writer Rebecca Mackay has been shortlisted for the National Book Award for her latest novel, set in Chicago and Wisconsin during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. We'll revisit our interview with her next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. It was an exciting Wednesday for Illinois writer Rebecca Mackay. Her latest novel, The Great Believers, was shortlisted for the National Book Award. It's a distinction that's well-deserved for the book's sensitive and nuanced portrayal of the AIDS crisis as it played out in the Midwest, Chicago and Wisconsin, of the 1980s.
The book is a sweeping portrayal of that time through the eyes of Yale, his partner Charlie, and their friends and colleagues in the gay community. It also jumps forward to contemporary Paris and a mother's search for her estranged daughter. But it's the book's ability to capture the feeling of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s Midwest that Rebecca Mackay and I talked about at Boswell Book Company recently. Rebecca Mackay, welcome back to Milwaukee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Always.
Is it true that the AIDS crisis was initially a subplot for you in this book?
Yes, which I then became very quickly uncomfortable with. And I really started initially with this idea of a woman who had been an artist's model around World War I in Paris. That was my initial, you know, I was sitting in a cab, I had this idea, this is my book, right? So I thought, I want her at the end of her life looking back, basic math that couldn't have been later than the 80s. So I feel like, okay, I have her in the 80s. She's in conversation with some art guy in the 80s about these sketches she has of her from that time. I have an art guy in the 80s. That's an excuse to write about the AIDS crisis, which is something I've been interested in for my whole life, basically, but interested in writing about for a while. I had a story in my story collection about the AIDS crisis. And for me, as I consider a novel, I have about a year-long period, usually, where I'm just working it over mentally. I am not writing anything. And during that time, I feel really embarrassed when anyone asks me about my work. There's this scene, do you guys remember Amadeus in 1984, the Tom Hulce movie? And he's like totally drunk, and he's the mysterious man in black comes to ask him if he's been working on the Requiem he's supposed to be writing, and he's totally drunk, and he's like, yes, I have it all written down. And the guy's like, where is it? And he's like, it's all up here in my noodle. That's what I feel like during that year, of like, yes, I'm writing. And if I had to turn to any pages, there are no pages, and I feel nuts. But during that time, I'm reconsidering a lot of things, I'm rearranging a lot of things mentally. And one of the things that happened during that time was a couple things. One was, as I started to research, starting to get the lay of the land through research on art world of lost generation Paris, and I'm starting to get the lay of the land on Chicago AIDS generation. And the gravity was starting to shift really rapidly. It's not that, you know, I'm constantly gonna be in love with lost generation Paris, but it felt like the tenor of the metaphor. It felt like the thing that should be mentioned, you know, out of scene, where AIDS generation Chicago was just stealing the gravity. So that's one thing. And the other thing was,
I was just gonna say, so when you said before you were uncomfortable with AIDS only being a subplot.
That's the thing. So this is the second thing. I was thinking about the number of movies, TV shows, books that I've consumed in which AIDS is a subplot. And some of them are masterpieces. I don't, you know, there's nothing wrong with them individually. But taken collectively, I think most of what mainstream America consumes is AIDS as a whitewashed subplot, where typically someone is diagnosed, it may be not the main character, they die very melodramatically, but very cleanly off stage.
Mark Harmon in St. Elsewhere.
Yes, exactly. Very typically, the way that their death is realized is someone goes to visit them in the hospital, and the hospital bed is empty, right? Which I think, if I ever wrote an essay about this, it would be called The Empty Bed, right? Like, it's we didn't have to see it, we didn't have to deal with it, but isn't it dramatic? Isn't it symbolic? And now back to the main story. And I just couldn't bear to do that. And again, individually, and I'm not calling St. Elsewhere a masterpiece, but there are masterpieces of art, right, that do this. It's not any one of them individually. It's the fact that collectively it starts to become a problem. Why is it pushed off to the side? Let's actually focus on it. Let's look at Dead in the Eyes. I just couldn't do it as a subplot.
You said you have wanted to write about, you've been interested in and you've wanted to write about AIDS generation Chicago or elsewhere for practically your whole life, I'm assuming your whole professional life anyway.
Yeah.
Do you have firsthand memories of that time that underpin the era as you describe it?
Yes, but they are remote. They have to do with what I saw on TV. You know, my parents had one colleague, my parents were in academia, they had one colleague who my mother was close to who died of AIDS, but I don't think I knew about that until I was a little bit older. It was no one I knew. I really believe, it's really interesting, I think I talk to anyone a little bit younger than me, they don't understand at all. I talk to anyone a little bit older than me and they go, yeah, I understand, but why would you, you know, why were you drawn to do this? And I talk to people just about exactly my age, and to be honest, I'm 40, so I think people get it instantly. People exactly my age, how foundational this understanding was for, maybe not everyone, for a lot of us. You know, you watch the news, I mean, because this is, you know, we're all staying up until midnight and watching 2020 because, you know, it's the 80s, whatever, no one cares. You stay home from school sick, you watch Donahue, you pick it up, right? whatever it was that I saw, and it wasn't coming from my home, it was not coming from school, it was from TV, to be fully honest, as a child, it was coming at me. And I had a child's porous sense of empathy, where I had not been taught to otherize these people, because my parents never talked about that stuff at all. I had not been, I didn't have any pre-existing prejudices, experiences, anything. This was John Stossel or whoever talking to me and me going, oh my God.
You weren't old enough to be jaded.
Not at all. No. I instantly felt for these people. I think, identified them as my people, which has been born out in life, and was horrified and got it. And I had a really weird experience as I was researching. I ended up watching on YouTube. I believe it was Donahue. I was joking about that, but there was a Donahue episode. It was a bunch of members of the New York chapter of ACT UP talking on Donahue in, I'm going to guess, 1989 or 1990. I was watching it, and about halfway through went, oh my God, I saw this. I saw this when it was first on. I was 10, I was 11, I was 12, I was somewhere in there. It wasn't when they were talking, it was when someone in the audience, some woman stood up and said, what about this idea of quarantining everyone on an island? And I went, I saw that. And I was upset. And I was in my family room, and I don't remember beyond that, but I saw this. And, you know, these people were going on this show. There was this, you know, this panel of people. They were pleading for their lives. They're trying to speak to people contemporaneously. They're, you know, and, you know, I would love to take a time machine back and tell them, you know, you were also reaching children, you know, that there, maybe we shouldn't have been watching daytime TV. There are better ways to center. But like, you were, I'm sure that in their mind, they were thinking, I'm speaking to people my age, I'm speaking to politicians, I'm speaking to policymakers right now. And you were also speaking to 10-year-olds who were homesick from school, who listened and who got it.
So it was in the background, at least until sex ed in high school. You're experiencing it kind of, I don't want to say vicariously, because that's not quite the right word, but you're experiencing it secondhand. What was your process like to appreciate the feel of what it was like to experience that era firsthand?
Yeah, so this is very different, right? I really believe strongly, and I'm glad that I knew this from the beginning, because I didn't waste any time, that you can't empathize your way all the way into that point of view. I have an overactive imagination, that's going for me. I could not have just sat down in a vacuum and correctly empathized, correctly imagined this experience. So here's the thing. As I set out to do my research, I realized very quickly that there is nothing in book or film form about the AIDS crisis in Chicago. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the same is probably true for Milwaukee. When we look at what is recorded, it's New York, San Francisco, it might be LA, it might be Paris and London. Chicago, you know, wasn't it? It's the third biggest city in America. There are pages in coffee table books, you know, out and proud in Chicago, 1812 to 2013, and you have three pages in there. Chicago's not even in the index of a book like How to Survive a Plague by David France and the band Played On, right? And Chicago is the least of the issue. You know, Milwaukee, which, sidebar, you guys know, I've been telling the story everywhere just as an example of why the stories of other cities need to be told. The 1993 Cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee, which went in the news as Kevin killed a couple of hundred people, largely the elderly and those with compromised immunity. What that meant was that basically everyone with HIV within the city of Milwaukee died in about 2 weeks. It was not reported, it was completely swept under the rug, and I sat down with someone at one point from Chicago who had Milwaukee roots, and he's trying to show me photo albums, and one of the things he thinks is a photo album is actually a scrapbook of funeral bulletins. And he opens it up, and they're all flying every direction, something that I actually wrote into my book later, a scene very much like this. And the reason they'd all been stuffed in there, and he'd never organized them, is they were all from Milwaukee within about a month of each other. And, you know, so that story is so different from the story of San Francisco. It's so different from the story of New York. And those aren't the stories that people absorb. They're, you know, people think they know this narrative. They have no idea, and it's absolutely different. And then you have cities like, so I was in Dubuque, Iowa last week. You would not think that that was a place where the AIDS epidemic struck. Here's what you have, a medium-sized city. It's the kind of city you leave if you're young and gay, right? So people did that. They moved home when they were dying. So one of the people who came to my reading was this doctor who was an epidemiologist, who was the guy that people would come to in Dubuque if they were, if they had something like this. So he's the guy who's suddenly dealing with 20, 30 cases of AIDS in Dubuque, Iowa, which you would not think, right, would have its own story. Anyway, so I set out to research Chicago. This is not a story that's out there. It's not been published, and that, which kills me, which meant that what I had to do was primary source research. I was, for my own work, I'm so glad that I was forced into those first-person interviews and so grateful for the people who gave me their time. On the broader scale, I'm really freaked out that this stuff is not chronicled in nonfiction, in film or in book form, and that's my soapbox right now. We need to get it written down.
Well, and I was wondering, is there a point at which the history kind of stops? I mean, you said you went back through the Windy City Times through like 1992. Is there a point at which people stopped looking at that era?
Not the Windy City Times. You know, I stopped there because that's when chronologically, you know, so people haven't read the book. There are two major time periods in the book. I have the 80s, and that it's largely 85, 86, but it goes through 92. But then every other chapter is 2015 Paris, where the woman whose brother's memorial service starts the book is trying to track down her estranged daughter. But largely, you know, largely the time frame of the book is 85 to 92. So I'm stopping in 92 in part because I need to limit my knowledge, right? But no, I think someplace like the Windy City Times, absolutely not. They are still absolutely chronicling it, absolutely never stopped, right? But I've been appalled at the number of people who have said things to me like, wow, there must be so many parallels to the modern day, which I understand the sentiment. Yes, absolutely, we can make parallels to, you know, regimes that don't consider you a human, things like that. There are 35 million people in the world living with HIV right now. That's not a parallel. It's still happening, right? AIDS is still the eighth leading cause of death for Americans aged 25 to 34. And I'm getting comments all the time from people going like, yeah, I remember that time. You know, that was really bad, but now it's such a manageable condition. It's almost like just having diabetes or asthma. It's not. I'm disturbed to see that for many of the same reasons that originally a blind eye was turned, it's those people over there, marginalized people, it's them, that's never gonna happen to me, never mind. We finally acknowledged it, we finally addressed it. As a nation, we looked at it, not perfectly, but we looked at it. And again, we're turning a blind eye to it for other reasons very similar to the original ones, which is that now it's largely African Americans who have this, who have HIV. It's largely people in Africa rather than the United States who have HIV. I feel like it's a return to silence and a return to ignorance in a way that I look at these people that I have come to worship, these early people in ACT UP, and, you know, some of them are still around. I know them. And I know how horrified they are by that return to ignorance. And I think about some of the ones who gave their lives in this fight and how horrified they would be. And I just, you know, it's troubling.
Rebecca Mackay recorded on stage at Boswell Book Company in August. Her latest novel, The Great Believers, was shortlisted this week for the National Book Award.
One more break, and then we'll talk about a brand new cheese from a big name in the business here in Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The seasons have noticeably changed this week, and while we might have been thinking about iced coffee or tea when the week began, today it's feeling much more like a grilled cheese and tomato soup kind of day.
We are not here to talk about tomato soup today, but we are going to talk about cheese and a new variety that might make a perfect substitute for what you were planning to make your grilled cheese with. Our cheese contributor, Jeanette Hurt, is with us. Welcome back to the show. It is great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
It is always wonderful to have you here, partly because we enjoy your company on the show, but partly because we enjoy the cheese you bring us. And I guess let's start with the biggest amount of cheese that is on the console. This is not just an impressive wheel of cheese in front of us, but it is a wheel of cheese that is essentially brand new that the people
at
Roth
made. It's a new cheese, and it's made by a woman cheesemaker, Madeline, and what is interesting is because Emmy Roth, which used to be known as Roth or Roth Kaiser, is a Swiss family-owned company that goes back five or six generations in Switzerland. And about 15 or 20 years ago, they decided to come to the United States instead of just exporting. They were curators of cheese that would export to the United States, but then they, of course, went to the little Switzerland of the United States, which is in Greene County, and they are located in Monroe, which is the name of this cheese. They have won probably hundreds of awards, both national and international. Their signature cheese is their Grand Cru, which is this aged Alpine-style Swiss cheese. I guess you could say it's similar to Gruyere, but it's an American original. And they make a lot of other cheeses. They make Goudas, and they make blue cheese. And we have some, on the other end, some new snack cheeses they made, which we'll talk about in a minute. But what's really exciting about Monroe, outside of the fact it's a new cheese, it's the only cheese of its kind being made in Wisconsin, it's a creamy washed rind cheese. Washed rinds are like Taleggios or the famous Limburger, which means they do have some smell to it because they are washed with a bacterial solution as they age.
And we're not recording this in smell-o-vision, but you can definitely, there is definitely a smell to this.
But it's not unpleasant. It doesn't smell like stinky socks or barnyards, but it is more of an earthy style. But when you taste it, it tastes really creamy, luscious. It's almost like a double cream brie, but brie is a creamy Bloomy rind. Bloomy rinds are like, this is similar to a bloomy rind in texture, but the rind is washed. Bloomy rinds are not washed. They're made and then they age and they have that nice sort of crisp, but not exactly crisp sort of bloomy rind. But this one is like the texture of a bloomy rind, but the color and the smell and the flavor is a little deeper. I will say this cheese makes a fantastic grilled cheese sandwich, and you can also throw it in pasta. And you don't have to eat the rind, which is the most aromatic part.
You anticipated my question there, because that is really a personal preference kind of
decision. It's whether you want to or not. It's the same like bloomy rind cheeses. A lot of people like brie, but they cut off the bloomy rind. Same with the washed rind. You can cut it off. It tastes just fine. It's quite lovely. I think you should taste it.
I think I should taste it too.
So again, you look at it, it's on the outside, it's got this slightly rose, orangey rose color. And then on the inside, it's a really rich, creamy ivory color. And then there are some little holes, which you can see. And one thing I will say with both bloomy rinds and washed rinds, as they age, I mean, you can buy them, they're aged a certain amount of time and then released, and then you can age it more in your... The longer you wait to eat it, the creamier and lighter in texture they become on the inside, and they also become more aromatic. But
it almost looks like, I mean, you were talking about this as a grilled cheese, and it almost looks like it's melting even cold.
Yes. I mean, you smell and then take a taste, and...
Oh, that is delicious.
Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
It's got that richness that they're known for Alpine-style cheeses. Mm. And you who traveled to Switzerland this past year are very familiar with Alpine style of cheeses, and they're aged, and they, you know, Swiss cheese with the holes, and also they're washed, typically washed rinds on the outside. So that gives them the extra flavor as things go in.
And but definitely not dissimilar from a brie.
The texture, the flavor, but it's different.
Yeah.
And it's an American original. You can get it here in Whole Foods, or you can get it at Fromage Nation in Madison. And speaking of Madison, this cheese would go very well with a Madison-made cider. There's a new cidery that opened up, and it's inside of a distillery. It's called Hidden Cave Cidery, and Walker Fanning is the cider maker. And he uses dessert apples because that's what we mostly grow, because he doesn't own his own orchard, so he can't use the heritage or traditional cider-making apples. And then he uses things like rose hips and rosemary and other herbs to create these really interesting ciders, which would pair very well with these style of cheeses. And then we'll go quickly to some
that
of...
That is, but before we go on any further... That is among the most delicious cheeses I have ever had.
Wonderful. Isn't it good?
That is remarkable.
Now, these are milder cheeses. Another thing Roth is doing is they are doing snack cheeses. And I think these are probably competing with the Baby Bells or the Mini Brie's. They've got a creamy mozzarella,
okay,
a creamy Gouda, and a creamy cheddar. So these are the kind of things, as you can see with the packaging, you can take to go, open up. And they could be for school lunches or picnics or snacks on the go.
I feel like I should at least try the creamy Gouda right now.
Yes. And they make some wonderful, wonderful Goudas. So this is, it's less aged, but it's still quality cheese making, quick, on the go, snacking.
It is excellent. It doesn't compete with the Monroe, honestly. But
well, no. Maybe we should have started with the snack cheeses.
Maybe, exactly. I feel bad because this is among the better Goudas I've had in a while. But
it's not. It's a snack cheese. And not that you can't snack on Monroe, but that's the other thing. It's a limited release. So it would be a great cheese for your holiday cheese plates or entertaining. And it's not always made. They don't make it year-round. They release it. It's a limited release, just like Rush Creek Reserve for Uplands. They have their limited release for the holidays.
I'm told the Pleasant Ridge Reserve has a special limited release that comes out in the fall.
No, that's Rush Creek Reserve. It's a separate cheese, but similar. It's, again, more of a creamy cheese. It's a little bit stinky. It's delicious. But it's only made, and the Rush Creek is made when they only put their cows off of pasture, and it's a certain limited amount of time, and they only release it in the fall.
That the gentleman at the cheese store I was speaking with was talking about exactly that, but he had the wrong product in mind.
Yeah. Pleasant Ridge Reserve, on the other hand, that's released, that's usually available year-round because it's an aged cheese, and it lasts longer.
Okay.
So, and they also use it. Pleasant Ridge is made when the cows are fully on pasture, and they only use certain milkings, and it's a very, that's the Beaufort, another Alpine style cheese. And although we didn't sweep the Alpine style cheese categories this year at the American Cheese Society, we did once again as a state for the 14th year in a row win more awards than any other state. This year we won 94 awards, or 26% of all awards given, and we swept 5 categories, including Italian grating flavored fettas, original brick and brick Munster, as well as, and several companies took several. Klondike took 12 awards, Belgioso took 9, Maple Leaf took 7, and Emmy Roth took 6.
So even though they're no grand champions, certainly nothing to be ashamed of.
Well, no, and they won several first place awards. The other thing I was going to say about them, they are grand champions. They have, their grand crew has won in previous years. And it's one of those things. I don't think the Cheese Society picks the same cheese every year, although they could. And they did once in 2 years in a row, I believe Pleasant Ridge won. Or it's the only cheese that has won twice, the same cheese. So I think that's a testament, again, to our cheese making. And we also, as you know, make other fermented products.
So, yeah, you mentioned the Hidden Cave Cidery in Madison in talking about this Monroe, but there is another cidery that's doing some pretty remarkable things.
Yes, and that's Island Orchard Cidery up in Door County. And they are a traditional cider house. They make it in the Normandy style or French style of hard cider. And one of the things they're making this fall, and it's going to be a very limited release, and I got to taste this summer when I went up there, is a spirit. And what it is, it's a version of Pommeau. Pommeau is an apple liqueur that's made in Normandy. But since he's not making it in Normandy, he makes it. He's calling it Pomona, after the Roman goddess of apples.
Not after the city in California.
No, no. But I will say the other thing I have to mention about it is how it's made. He has, and this is a Milwaukee connection, he takes his cider and he has it distilled into brandy. He has Great Lakes Distillery distill it into an eau de vie, which is like a clear, colorless brandy. And then he takes that and he ages it with fresh apple cider in oak barrels. And I got to taste it right out of the barrel, and it's a creamy, luscious, viscous liqueur that smells like a freshly picked apple. So again, it would go so well with cheese. It's an only limited release, which you can order it online or right at the cidery, which is open year-round. But if you're interested, you might want to call or email to find out when he's releasing it, because he didn't have an exact date when I was interviewing him. But it's really, really good.
And we should mention, although it's still a ways off, you are hard at work on a book on ciders.
Yes, I am. It's called The Joy of Cider, and it's due in my publisher's office next year or so. Early next year.
I imagine we will have you in this very studio to talk about that when it comes out.
Yes.
But between now and then, I look forward to more cheese.
Definitely. There's always more cheese.
Jeanette Hurt, thank you as always.
You're quite welcome.
Milwaukee writer Jeanette Hurt is the author of several books about cheeses and cocktails, including The Cheeses of Wisconsin, A Culinary Travel Guide, and Drink Like a Woman. She's also our regular cheese contributor. And that wraps up Thursday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.